Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Every day, more than 115 people in the U.S. die after overdosing on opioids. It has been declared a public health emergency. Here in Pennsylvania, the opioid epidemic is impacting our family members, friends, teachers, first responders, and perhaps most importantly, our children. It's estimated that a baby is born every 25 minutes suffering from opioid withdrawal. 2.9 million children are being raised by grandparents today. So on today's program, the first segment of this program, we're going to talk about how the opioid crisis is affecting our children. It's part of WITF's Battling Opioid Project, our partnership with six other public media stations across the state. Joining us on today's program, Wendy Lorenzo, who is helping to raise her grandson. She lost her daughter, Liz, to an overdose of opioids. Wendy, good to see you again.
Nice to see you too, Scott.
Also joining us is Dr. Jennifer Chambers, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer at Capital Blue Cross. Dr. Chambers, good to see you.
Good morning and thank you.
And as part of disclosure, if you listen to Smart Talk on a regular basis, you realize that Capital Blue Cross is one of our sponsors. Health Smart. We have a lot of smarts in our titles of our programs. WITF's Health Smart is this Wednesday night, Children of the Opioid Epidemic. It's Wednesday night at 9 on WITF-TV. Here's an excerpt from that.
Still doesn't really seem real. I don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about what happened, quite honestly, because it just really hurts and you can't change anything. The only thing I can really do is try to help other people and make it a better world for my grandson. He knows that his mom's not here. We tell him that she's in heaven. I mean, he helps us all get through the grief. I'm not sure he knows how much he helps us, but there's a lot of weight. That little boy's carrying a lot of weight for all of us to be able to deal with the loss.
Wendy, I don't know whether you have heard that or not. Is it,
no.
Is it the first time you've heard it? Well, that is part of Health Smart, Children of the Opioid Crisis, this Wednesday night at 9. Talking about your daughter, Liz, and your grandson, Carson, who you are helping to raise. And first of all, tell me a little bit about Liz. Tell me about your daughter, Liz.
Well, I always tell everyone my daughter had only child syndrome, which means that, you know, anything that happened in her life was somewhat manifested a million times because we had no other children to focus on, you know. But my daughter was a probably one of the most warm-hearted people I've ever met. And, you know, I don't say that just because she's my daughter. You know, I would always tell her, and I shared this at her funeral. I said, Liz, you are the most beautiful girl I've ever seen. And she says, Mom, you always tell me that. You just say that because you're my mother. I said, no, if you were ugly, I would tell you. I would be honest. And we would laugh about that. And, you know, we would have that conversation quite often. But, you know, my daughter, after high school, went on to beauty school, and she became a very talented beautician. She was somewhat of a psychological major because people would sit in her chair and talk about their problems. And she had got into a relationship with someone in addiction, and, you know, she tried to help him out of it, and that led her down a dark path, and she went to rehab and got into recovery. And after that, you know, that's when people, you know, started to talk more about their addictions, and she would really try to help them. So, you know, she would call me sometimes and say, Mom, you know, this person needs help, and I don't know what to do. And I'd say, Liz, like, you got your own problems, you know, why are you trying to help everyone else? And she'd say, because that's what I have to do. And so after she passed, that's how the Eye Care Foundation started, because I felt that we needed to pick up where my daughter left off and get people help. When she was in addiction, I didn't handle it very well. I tell people that all the time. I was mad, angry, ashamed. And when she came out of rehab, we still didn't really talk about it. You know, I knew nothing about heroin addiction at the time. I had no idea of the effects that it has on one's brain, on one's body, that it's a physical addiction. And you don't just overcome it in 16 days in rehab. But I didn't know that.
Is that what she was in rehab, just 16 days?
16 days, which you figure 7 of that is detox. So, yeah, definitely not long enough. And when she came out, she went into intensive outpatient therapy and didn't really mesh well with her counselor. So, you know, at one point she's like, Mom, it's just really not helping. I don't think I'm going to keep going. And then she got pregnant. And then, of course, life really changed. And, you know, my whole thought process was, well, now she's pregnant. That's, you know, definitely going to keep her on the road to recovery. And so when my daughter relapsed, she was 19 months in recovery. There were some warning signs the week before she died. And again, had I known that some of the things that she was telling me were warning signs, I would have got her help, but I didn't know.
What was she like after she had started using heroin? I mean, did her personality change? Did your relationship change? You said you didn't handle it very well, but did you see changes in Liz?
Well, let's go back to the relationship that she was in with the person in addiction. That was a 2-year relationship, and even when she wasn't in addiction, because this person was, my daughter became a person that I did not know, even when she wasn't doing heroin, because she wanted so much to try to support this person, it completely ruined her life. Yes, she became very angry. You couldn't talk to her. Her life was completely out of control. He was a controlling person. He was abusive. He stole her money, wrecked her car. They stole money from her dad. You know, all things that he needed to do to get money to buy drugs. So we really ended up not, I don't want to say disowned her, but, you know, got to a point where we tried the tough love approach and just sort of said we were done. And that's when she hit rock bottom. She confided in a family friend, and that's when they took her to rehab.
So March 19th, 2016 is when Liz passed away. Mm-hmm. She overdosed on heroin. What happened?
Well, my daughter was overprescribed prescription medications. First of all, she was, after she had my grandson and returned back to work full time as a beautician, she was, you know, obviously stressed. Depressed. I thought it was some postpartum depression. She was on 2 antidepressants, Ativan and Adderall. And the Adderall was prescribed March 13th, which is really heartbreaking when you look back and see that another drug had been prescribed to her, you know, 2 weeks before she passed. So she's on, like, you know, 3 downers and an upper, and then she gets heroin that's cut with fentanyl. And after having conversations with our Dauphin County coroner, Graham Hetrick, my daughter was given a cocktail for death. So her heart stopped immediately. She did the drug with her fiance, Kyle. Kyle survived. Liz didn't. And I attribute that to the overprescription of prescription medications.
Was she in your home?
Or? No, she was in her dad's. They had Kyle had fallen asleep after he did heroin. He fell asleep before Liz did it. Liz did it. Kyle woke up at some point. The lights were still on. He looked over. He saw her slumped over. He ran and got my ex-husband. They performed CPR. They called 911. They called me at 4 a.m., said, you got to get down here. I said, what happened? He said, Liz overdosed. I said, is she breathing? He said, no. And so by the time we got down there, you know, walking in on the whole situation, you know, call it mother's intuition, I don't know. But I had a feeling at that point she was gone.
Yeah. So sorry for your loss, what Liz went through, what your whole family went through. But she did have a son, mm-hmm. Carson, mm-hmm. and you're helping to raise Carson?
There's a lot of us helping to raise Carson. They still live with my ex-husband, Kyle, which let me just say, Kyle, my daughter's fiance, who now is, you know, my son.
This isn't the same.
No,
this isn't the same
this
guy.
This is a different.
Okay.
Yeah, this is a different guy. Actually, she met Kyle in rehab, which I was not at all happy about either. But I am convinced that had she not got in a relationship with Kyle, she very well may have went back to the old relationship, because honestly, that was the drug. That person, and people can be drugs also, and that person was a drug to her. So I'm glad that her and Kyle did get together. Kyle is now, 18 months in recovery. Kyle is doing wonderful. We attribute a lot of that also to Vivitrol. We are huge. The Eye Care Foundation is huge proponents for the Vivitrol. I was on Vivitrol for 7 months for alcohol dependency, and I can tell you it does work. It's an opioid and alcohol blocker. So not to get away from Carson, but Kyle's doing very well. He works a full-time job. He's a full-time dad, and he's also taking classes at HAC. So I just want to mention how proud I am of him. And yes, Carson is now a little over two. He is, I don't know, just an exceptionally happy child. He spends every day with his, Kyle's mom, his other grandma, and, you know, we get him a lot on the weekends, we get him a lot at night. So there's a lot of people that are helping take care of Carson, and Carson is also our therapy. He's the one that's helping us get through this, and part of the reason why I started the Eye Care Foundation, to help other people and to make this a better world for him. You know, this whole epidemic is very scary, and I just want this to be a better world for my grandson.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Chambers, this Battling Opioids project that WITF and the other public media stations are involved in right now, we're just one of many, including Blue Cross. There are many partners in this fight against opioid, but stories like Wendy's lets us know that this is not just a numbers game. These are real people that we're talking about. You know, I've said before, if there's any positive that has come out of all this, is that so many people realize that it is a huge problem, and so many organizations, so many people are in that fight, including Blue Cross. What do you think when you hear a story like Wendy's?
Well, first of all, let me offer, you know, I'm so sorry for your loss. I'm sitting here near tears hearing this story. And so one of the things that I think is so critical is education. And, you know, our kids are being offered these things on a daily basis. And we have to figure out the right way that we can give our kids the wherewithal, the information they need to say no. And one of the issues is we talk about facts. And that's part of education. But what we just heard today is relevance and understanding, which are the two next pieces when you're going to have information stick in your brain and help you to make the right decisions when that issue comes to light. When you are offered a drug and you have an emotional attachment to a story, is really critical for you to be able to remember, this is a bad idea and I need to say no to this. And so we at Capital have, you know, We've employed a program with our pharmacy partner called the Pharmacist Teach Program, and we get a pharmacist and a person in recovery, on their recovery journey, to speak to kids in an assembly-like situation where the pharmacist, yeah, they speak to the facts and the physical changes and dependence that develops, and that person in recovery then tells their story. And they'll tell their story and the story of friends who have died and the impact that this has had on their life. And that's the kind of thing that's going to stick in their memory bank, so that when that issue comes to light, when someone offers them something, they're going to be able to say no. We have to remember that kids, adolescents in particular, as their judgment centers aren't formally developed yet. And so their ability to have the judgment just innately to say no isn't quite there yet. And we have to give them all the information so that they can make an informed decision. It's worked with tobacco. It's worked with alcohol to a certain extent as well. We have to make sure that they have that information. And I will tell you that emotional piece is what's going to make the difference. Just hearing the facts won't help them to say no. I have my youngest daughter, who is now almost 20. I remember vividly the day that she told me when she was in the sixth grade in middle school, and I said, "Honey, how was your day?" And she said, "Oh, the dogs were brought in today, Mom." I said, "Oh, the service dogs," because I work in the community with a program like that. I made an assumption. She said, "No, the drug dogs, Mom." And the DARE officer was there. And I said, "Oh, but they didn't find anything, right?" And she said, "Oh, yeah, they always find something. Oh, this wasn't the first time the dogs have been in. Oh, no." And my older daughter, who was in high school, said, "Mom, this is part of high school life. This is normal that they come in and they sniff out the drugs that are in the lockers." And so if we are naive enough to think that this isn't happening on a daily basis in our school systems, then we're not opening up the opportunity to prevent. And that's why we have really wanted to get into the schools to help them in this fight against the opioid epidemic.
You know, one of the things, though, that is different about this is that we know that there has been a drug problem in this country for much of the last 50 years. It's been different drugs. It was cocaine, crack cocaine, at one time heroin, mostly in inner cities. What's different about this is a lot of times it started with prescription opioids, mm-hmm. legal drugs, and then on to heroin. Heroin is so cheap now. But it's not just an inner city problem. It crosses all socioeconomic boundaries, all classes of people, all educational levels. And so I think that because it is so big, covers so much area, that's one of the real challenges here, that you not only have to get to, if science says, if research says, these are the people that are most likely, the kids that are most likely to, we can't find those kids nowadays. They're everywhere.
That's right. You know, I call this an equal opportunity issue. There is no socioeconomic group, no age, no gender, nothing that can predict whether someone is necessarily going to be become addicted to an opioid or any other drug for that matter. And so it's that access to those pills, which was one of the things, the other things that we, along with all other insurers in Pennsylvania, did. It was actually part of Attorney General Josh Shapiro's 10-point challenge to us. And so it was to limit the number of pills that are being prescribed to folks who do receive an opioid prescription. And that's a critical piece here. We needed to have information, and the CDC actually helped us with, you know, publishing guidelines on opioid use for chronic pain. We know now that they are not effective in treating chronic pain, can make it worse, and that dose and duration matter with the risk of addiction. And so the lower the dose of the prescription, if it indeed is needed, and the shorter the duration, the lower the risk of someone really becoming dependent and addicted on that drug. And so we implemented something called quantity level limits. So we limited the number of pills per day, and we limited the number of days. And we had, you know, some results that really spoke to really the impact. We saw a 40% decrease in the total number of opioid prescriptions being written. Imagine that. And that's important because we know from the data out of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association, 1 in 4 people who are insured by a Blues plan, that's 41 million Americans, had received an opioid prescription in 2016. That's a fourth of all of us received a risk drug for the development of addiction. And if we don't limit those prescriptions, we're providing pills for diversion, pills for abuse, and ultimately for addiction. We know that so many heroin users, more than 80%, started with an opioid prescription drug before they developed that addiction. And so we have to, you know, we have to start at square one and make sure that we're limiting the number of pills that are getting out there. And then when a prescription is even considered, the doctor and the patient need to have a conversation. And that's called shared decision making. And that means that when you're talking about your pain situation, first, is an opioid appropriate? Do I think you need one from my medical judgment? And then here are the risks that are associated with this medication. And I think after that conversation, if it's real, most people will say no, thank you. And we're going to be able to impact, you know, the ultimate development of addiction one person at a time, one prescription at a time, and then one kid at a time if we can prevent them from saying yes.
And that's, you know, we wanted to focus on during this portion of the program on children. And I think that what what Wendy's story shows and Liz's story shows is that this is not just something that the person who is using heroin or has a dependency on opioid medications, that they're not the only ones impacted by this. I mean, family members, but children in particular. I mean, Wendy, you see it firsthand. You're helping to raise a grandson now who's 2 years old. Dr. Chambers, what about, I mean, I use that statistic about babies born addicted. I mean, again, this is so heartbreaking, and these are lifelong problems that some of these kids may have.
Yeah, we need to, and if a baby is born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, I don't know if anyone has seen videos of the torment that these babies actually go through, but it is heartbreaking. And we need to understand that that child's going to need extra support during the course of their life, because that is a traumatic event right at the time they enter this world. And we need to also support the parents, because their children may indeed have certain disabilities as a result of that exposure, you know, while they're in utero and shortly after birth. Making sure that we have the right access to care is an important consideration here.
What do we do about that? Because access to care is a real issue.
Mm-hmm. It's a real issue in a couple of fronts. First is in the, you know, we don't have enough psychiatrists and psychologists to support people in their counseling journey. And then secondarily, we don't have enough providers that offer MAT or medication-assisted treatment. It's one of the most important evidence-based treatments that we have available to us to keep people on their recovery journey and not relapsing into addiction. And so there are certain drugs. Vivitrol was just mentioned, Suboxone being another. Methadone, all are effective. There's all of those have good evidence published in the literature, but we don't have enough providers that can offer them and prescribe them, and then make sure that the person is wrapped around with the right psychological care as well, because a medication in and of itself, particularly early in the recovery journey, is not going to be enough. They're going to need that counseling support. All of the stressors in life don't go away when you go off to detox and then come back. The stressors in your community, the things that really triggered you to use in the first place, are still going to be there, and people are going to need enough counseling support in addition to the medication-assisted treatment to help keep them on their recovery journey. But we continue to look for ways that we can encourage that, and we work with, you know, national organizations, including the Blues Association, to help us identify the right ways that we can encourage, even family practitioners to support us with medication-assisted treatment, and to encourage people to go into the fields of psychology and psychiatry. We just need more of them.
And, you know, I think how it shows itself, that lack of access, is someone who tries to get an appointment with a psychiatrist may wait for a long time to get that. Wendy, what do you worry about with Carson? I mean, I know there's a whole lot of things to worry about for a two-year-old, but in relationship to what he learns about his mother, what he learns when he becomes of age, just like Dr. Chamber, the two of you described, of when they become teenagers, what do you worry about?
Well, the first thing I worry about is when Carson becomes old enough to understand that his mother passed away of a drug overdose, because obviously, with running the Eye Care Foundation, we're not going to be able to keep that a secret from him. But what I want him to know is that he can be proud of the fact that his mother loved him and wanted him more than anything in life. And we're going to bring him into this organization. We're going to bring him into the Eye Care Foundation, and we're going to get him involved early. And we're going to hopefully have him be an advocate on the teenage level to know that, drugs took my mother's life. And hopefully he can help save other teens. I'm not going to really sit here and worry about things that I can't control. I'm going to think about the positive ways that we're going to be able to help him and influence his life, and not only his life, but all of the other teens that are going to be surrounded around him. And that's what the Eye Care Foundation does now, is we try to get people help. And in that window of opportunity, we try to get them help right away. And luckily for us, we have a lot of resources out there that help us.
Wendy Lorenzo and Dr. Jennifer Chambers, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer at Capital Blue Cross, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We are in the midst of WITF's fall fundraising campaign. I'm joined by WITF's Transforming Health reporter, Brett Schultes. Brett, another powerful story we just heard.
Yeah, it's just such a big part of what we do is covering the issues that matter in our community. And this is one of those issues that we have covered quite a bit, opioid addiction, drug overdose deaths, and the community's response to it. And, you know, you and I were talking about this yesterday as well. Every time you hear one of those stories, it's just the tragedy becomes real again. And no amount of numbers or statistics can take away or should ever obscure the reality of that every time someone has a drug overdose death. And, you know, we've really, I think the narrative is continuing to evolve and change as this becomes something that WITF, Transforming Health, PA Post, and, you know, some of our other efforts as well have continued to relentlessly cover the opioid crisis, battling opioids. And it's something that we're hoping to move the needle on. And, you know, it's complex and no one person or news agency can do it alone, but it's a really important part of what we provide here at WITF.
Well, and something else I want to mention here is that, yes, the last segment was part of our Battling Opioids project with the other public media stations across the country, but WITF is involved in a lot more when you're talking about moving the needle. For example, WITF's Health Smart, Children of the Opioid Epidemic, airs tomorrow night at 9 on WITF-TV. Later this afternoon at 4, there's a preview event to kick off the Battling Opioids Project. It includes legislators, public media leaders, and those in recovery. It's at the Matthew J. Ryan Legislative Office Building Rotunda in Harrisburg. That's later this afternoon at 4. I bring that up because, yes, we do want people to tune in. We want people to attend. But it is also a good example of WITF in the community.
That's right, Scott. And I'm going to speak directly to listeners now, because if you value Smart Talk, if you value our efforts to cover things like the opioid crisis, healthcare, mental health issues, which we're doing more and more coverage of now, then we're asking you to help us to reach our fall pledge fundraising goal of $78,000 with your gift of support right now. So please go to WITF.org/give now. It doesn't matter if you make a $10 a month contribution, a $20 a month, or $100 a month, or if you are someone who wants to make a one-time gift. That is something that we value as well. So again, you can go to WITF.org/give now or give us a call at 1-800-233-9483.
Yes, Smart Talk listeners, we know that this is not a pleasant topic, obviously, but it's an important topic and one that we shine a light on, and it's very important, a very important part of our mission. Brett, we'll talk to you a little bit later.
Thanks, Scott.
Okay. Welcome back to Smart Talk. At tomorrow's show, we just want to tell you what we're talking about tomorrow. Another healthcare issue is vaping e-cigarettes. Vaping safe. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. More than 50 years ago, Philadelphia TV reporter Bill Baldini produced a groundbreaking expose on the inhumane conditions at the Pennhurst State School and Hospital. His report shed an uncomfortable light on the mistreatment of society's most vulnerable citizens, individuals with intellectual disabilities. Baldini's report was titled Suffer the Little Children and is credited with igniting the disability civil rights movement. 2 years ago, WITF-TV produced a documentary on Pennhurst called I Go Home, which will air again on November 8th at 8 p.m. There's also a new documentary produced by WITF-TV as a continuation of the intellectual disabilities topic. It's titled Going Home. It airs on November 15th at 8 p.m. The Pennhurst story is highlighted this week when Millersville University hosts a forum on disability rights and history this Friday, September 28th. Prominent advocates, policymakers, and scholars will address the history of disability rights and current concerns in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Joining us on Smart Talk today to discuss the forum and Suffer the Little Children report are Professor Dennis Downey, and who's a professor of history emeritus. Dr. Downey, good to see you again.
Good morning, Scott.
Also joining us is retired reporter Bill Baldini. Mr. Baldini, welcome to the show.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. And you can also leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Bill Baldini, I'm going to take it back to 1968, Pennhurst. What did you find at Pennhurst?
What I found was a stunning set of circumstances that I could hardly believe. It was absolutely astounding. Pennhurst was an institution out in Chester County, and at that time, that was nowhere. You know, people just didn't go that far out. And I didn't know anything about Pennhurst until I actually arrived. And when I did arrive, I was absolutely stunned at what I saw.
What did you see?
Well, when you go in there, you see these giant rooms filled with people of all ages, and they were half naked. They were pounding their heads against the wall. They were strolling around aimlessly. Some people had football helmets on because they pounded their heads so much, and they would have one or two attendants there to take care of them. And they would be living in their own feces. It was incredible. But the most stunning was one ward that had 80 cages. And in those cages, or metal cages, were 80 children. I mean, running from ages from 6 months to maybe 5 years old. And some of the 5-year-olds and the 4-year-olds could not walk at all because their legs were so small. And the reason was there weren't enough people to put them on the floor so they can learn how to crawl and then walk. So they just stayed in these cages day and night, 24/7, in their own feces with stickers to catch flies on each one of them. I could not believe what I saw. My crew didn't believe what they saw. Fortunately, we had cameras to shoot it. And to show other people, but it was a stunning revelation that I'll never forget.
Obviously, you asked questions. What were you told?
Yes.
What were you told, I mean, about those kind of conditions for people?
Well, the people who worked there, I want to get something straight. The people who worked there, most of them were caring individuals who were just overwhelmed, who felt hopeless. They could not move the system whatsoever. The system chose to ignore Pennhurst. It was a dumping ground for people with any kind of disability, and they mixed in mental disabilities with the physical disability people. It was absolutely astounding, and I couldn't have done what I did without the help of inside people. I want everybody to know that. I mean, when you have two people taking care of 80 people in cages all day, there is no way you could possibly do it. So, I don't know how they stayed there. It was just incredible to me.
So how did change come about?
Change came about only because of the public. When we put this on the air, we never had a reaction like that in the history of WCAU-TV in Philadelphia. Never. It was overwhelming. People were stunned. At the time, we had a policy, excuse me, that most of our pieces didn't go more than 130, maybe 145. I think my first one went about 7 or 8 minutes. And the reaction was overwhelming. People did not believe what they saw and were extremely upset, forcing us to go back the next day and the next day, and keeping this up. And every day, the audience even got bigger and angrier. And finally, the politicians had to react to it. And the irony of it all is the governor, who was Raymond Schaefer, he really disliked me by the end of this series because he felt we made him look bad. And it wasn't about him. It was about the whole system looking bad. But the irony of it all is that this Friday, I'm going to get an award from the present governor. So it's from one extreme, this guy hating me, to this governor giving me an award for what I did. I find that ironic.
So, Dennis Downey, you're a professor of history. How did you become interested in this topic? And I know this has been a passion of yours.
Well, it is a passion. It's Tom Gilhool, the attorney, said to me once, I will always be my brother's brother. In our family, we have a son with disabilities. And so, like for many folks, the personal became the public or the political. And I was invited to help work on a historical marker commemorating Pennhurst. And from that relationship and that work, a much broader kind of scholarly and personal agenda evolved to the point where not only this conference will occur, and it's our fourth, but also next year Jim Conroy and I will bring out a book with Penn State Press that documents the history of Pennhurst and its relationship to the disability rights movement.
Was Pennhurst unique, or was this worse, the worst of the worst?
No, I think that we have to think of Pennhurst in context. It was one of nearly 300 state-supported institutions around the country. There are also institutions beyond the United States, and they have remarkable similarities in terms of conditions and cultures and the social attitudes that lay behind them. Pennhurst, at its peak, had nearly 4,000 people in residence. Over 80 years, more than 10,000 Pennsylvanians lived there. No different than Polk, no different than other large-scale institutions around the country. Polk is in Venango County,
okay,
north of Pittsburgh.
Right. Okay.
And they were sort of sister institutions, but there's Elwin and Selins Grove. And at one point in the 1920s, Pennsylvania was supporting 60 different institutions committed to the care and also the oftentimes the segregation of people with various kinds of disabilities. So we were literally at the forefront of a national movement, and Pennhurst became center stage in that movement, and particularly the movement to bring about deinstitutionalization and the return to people to the community, which is one of the great unknown freedom struggles of the 20th century.
I mean, is it accurate to say that before Bill Baldini's reports and this came to light at Pennhurst, that society's attitude, at least government's attitude, was that, okay, there's nothing we could do for people with intellectual disabilities. This is what we do. We send them into institutions so that society doesn't have to bother with them.
Well, I think at one point, and this evolves out of what's called the eugenics movement, there is this sense that it's best for the individual, for the family, and for society. Society needs to be protected from people who are not only an economic drain, but they exhibit traits and behaviors that are socially undesirable and threatening. And so what may have begun as a model public health program very quickly deteriorated into something else. And I think in the post-World War II era, you see the power of advocacy, parents, organizations, and eventually the individuals themselves fighting against not only the social attitudes, but the conditions within the institutions. And here's where Bill's Suffer the Little Children was so groundbreaking. It gave a visual representation to what people were had been fighting over for decades, and it leads into litigation and a number of court cases that went all the way up to the Supreme Court, challenging the very foundation of institutionalization as dehumanizing and degrading. And Thurgood Marshall said that the conditions in institutions were as bad or worse than Jim Crow segregation. And that's a parallel worth thinking about.
It almost sounds like a concentration camp, quite frankly, from what Bill described.
Well, I mean, it's different, but there are similarities. I said to somebody yesterday regarding the the Halloween venue that's so popular at Pennhurst now. We wouldn't think of doing this at Auschwitz. Why would we do it on the grounds of former institutions where such atrocities, medical experimentation, psychological, sexual abuse, and other things occurred? And so there was a long struggle to not only expose what was happening, here's Bill's piece, but also to transform social and political will. You had to have the political will to bring this into being in the first place.
Bill, how long did it take before you actually saw those changes? I mean, I pointed to Suffer the Little Children, your reports, as being a turning point, but I imagine this was not something that turned overnight.
No, it did not. Because of the public advocacy, the politicians in Pennsylvania had to react. And, you know, the government moves slowly. It always moves too slowly for me. But it did finally react. After the expose went on the air, you can see a change in funding, slowly but surely. And then the momentum kept on going. I have to say one thing before I go any further. The mindset at the time, a lot of people wonder, how do these parents, how could they do this to their children? Well, the mindset at the time was, if you went to your doctor and your child had a disability, more than likely your doctor would tell you, you can't do anything about this. It would be a good idea to put your son or daughter in a place like Pennhurst. People had no place to go, so that's what they did. It wasn't that they didn't care. It's that they had no choices. And a lot of the cases that I looked into after were exactly that. People just didn't know how bad it was. And once they saw it, they kind of avoided it. It wasn't a pleasant place to go visit your son or daughter. So consequently, they didn't go that often, and they felt helpless. I have no place to turn. No one will listen to me. And it wasn't until the public was the real savior here. The public saw what was wrong and got on their politicians demanding change. So it changed in stages. And once the court cases started, the momentum really, really shifted.
We have an email from Colleen. It says, I work as a direct support professional for Person Direct Supports in Chambersburg. We actually just watched the video of I Go Home in employee training yesterday. I can say we have come a long way from Pennhurst, but there's still progress to be made in community integration, social opportunities, employment support, and general acceptance for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. You agree with that, Dennis?
I do, and as someone who has a son in a community living situation now, our Thomas will soon be 28, the respondent touches on a fundamental issue. As much as there has been significant change and improvement, there's so much more to go in not only changing social attitudes, but in continuing to create the structures and supports that help people be successful in their everyday lives. We have a waiting list that still has some 13,000 people in Pennsylvania alone waiting for services. The Wolf administration's been successful in reducing that. But one of the things you learn is we all need help and one way or another at some point in our life. And so there are, and the conference will speak to this. We have a session on adult services and employment and what happens after you age out of school-based supports. Sometimes people fall off the cliff.
So tell me about the event on Friday at Millersville.
Well, Millersville has sponsored several conferences and several other events throughout Pennsylvania. This is in cooperation with the Pennhurst Memorial and Preservation Alliance and Advocacy Group and a half dozen other institutional sponsors, including WITF, which has been very supportive in trying to get the message out and to create a community conversation, if you'd like. Our conference will combine history with public policy. How did we get to where we are? And specifically, when it comes to education and rights, advocacy, adult services, and employment, what does the future look like? And what can we do as parents and citizens to assist our fellow citizens in living successful and more complete lives?
When does the event start, and is it open to the public?
The event is open to the public. There's no charge. There's also free lunch. And it begins at 9 o'clock in the morning. It will end probably about 4. It's at the Winter Performing Arts Center at Millersville University. Designated parking. It's handicapped accessible. We welcome the public. We'll have a dozen exhibitors there. And we have already nearly 150 registrants. So it'll be a big deal.
Dr. Dennis Downey is a professor of history emeritus at Millersville University, author, historian. I don't know. How many other descriptions can I give you, Dennis?
Parent, dad.
And also reporter Bill Baldini. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. And it's part of WITF's fall fundraising campaign. And coming up, you probably heard the promotional announcement that we will have live coverage of President Trump's appearance before the United Nations. I'm joined by Brett Schultes, and Brett is WITF's Transforming Health reporter. Brett, there is a lot going on.
Yeah, I mean, just the two segments that you had on today are just two great examples of how much different kinds of guests you have on Smart Talk, the diversity of the show, and the many different things that we talk about here on this show. And everybody who's out there listening, first of all, I want to say thank you, Carol in Mechanicsburg, Stephen in Harrisburg, Marianne on Willow Street, Patricia in Halifax, Elizabeth in Lancaster, Barry in York, and so many other people who are making those contributions. If you haven't made a contribution yet, but you support the kind of programming that you hear this morning on Smart Talk, that you heard this morning on Morning Edition, and that you know that you can rely on with WITF, then now's the time. We are trying to finish up our fall pledge drive ahead of schedule. The fact is, we're not ahead of schedule right now. Help us to make that happen. Our goal ultimately is $78,000. But you know, like with many things, it starts with that small donation, whether it's $10, $20, or whether you feel comfortable making a $100 donation, whether you're a sustaining circle member who's going to make a monthly contribution, or somebody who just says, you know, I've been supporting and listening to public media for years, but I just haven't made that donation yet. Today's the day that you can also add your name to that board, really be one of those people that are heroes to us, right? When we see those supporters really making that statement. So again, the way to do that is to give online at WITF.org or call 1-800-233-9483.
We know that you are a loyal WITF listener. We know that you are a loyal Smart Talk listener, and I'm asking specifically for loyal Smart Talk listeners to make a contribution today. This is a program that we're celebrating our 10th anniversary this year. Yeah. We'll have a celebration next month of 10 years of Smart Talk. It came in response to the economic, the Great Recession of 2008, 2007, and it's continued to today, where we talk about issues like battling opioids, the opioid crisis, talk about how people, the history, the unfortunate history, the tragic history of how people with intellectual disabilities were treated and housed. I hate to say it that way, but that's what it was.
Yeah.
Description of today's program, but there's a lot of things going on that are related to WITF. WITF is such a major part of the community, and I have to tell you, Brett, I'm proud to tell people that I work at WITF, and I know that many people, because they've told me that they're proud to say that they're members of WITF. If you're not, We ask for your financial support. Go to WITF.org/give now or call 1-800-233-9483. Brett, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about vaping, e-cigarettes, whether they are safe. That's coming up on tomorrow's program.